All right, welcome everyone. First Dhamma talk of the afternoon. My name is Paisalo Bhikkhu. I ordained here in 2012. And I first came here as a guest in 2009 while I was living in Berkeley. And I would go to the first Tuesday at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery when Ajahn Pasano or Ajahn Amaro would come and give a Dhamma talk. And then I came here as a guest in 2009, stayed for a week, had a good experience. And then I came back the following summer for like 6 weeks, got time off work, and I stayed in the upper yurt. And Ajahn Amaro was still here, Ajahn Pasano, of course. And I liked it so much, I asked if I could come back the following year and stay for good. At that time, there wasn't room on the property. There were so many people that wanted to be anagarikas and not enough huts. So I was planning on staying across the street. But then, as things do, a few people left, space opened up, and so I was able to come the following June in 2010, and then became an anagarika that August. And then I think all in all, I was here for about 9 years. And it's interesting, the first time I've been back in about 5 years. I left in 2021, and I live now in a temple, New Hampshire, Ajahn Janto and Ajahn Anando's monastery out there. And I came back last year and was just blown away. It's so funny, you live somewhere for so long, and yet driving up and walking in, just seeing, it's pretty breathtaking, actually. It's a very beautiful monastery. And it's so strange to be struck by that every time I come back. And this time, myself and Ajahn Chaga, Ajahn Kovalo, Ajahn Pavar are staying across the street in the Santi Vihara. And in all that time of living here, I never really got that view from across the street. And it's totally different, as you can imagine. It's really a special place. I suppose all of you know that already. Thinking of Master Hua donating the majority of the land, very auspicious. And now it's 30 years later. I think Abhayagiri was started in 96, and that's when I graduated from high school. And I remember sort of being online in early 2000s and seeing pictures of Ajahn Yanako when he was an Anagarika leaf. And everything changes. And, you know, first it's Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano, and then it's just Ajahn Pasano. And then it's Ajahn Kunadamo and Ajahn Yanako, and now it's just Ajahn Yanako. And now Ajahn Yanako is a preceptor. It's all quite inspiring and very moving. And the monastery looks different in some ways, more buildings, more huts. But in some ways, it's the same as it's always been. And the purpose of the monastery is the same as it's always been. And I think that's one thing. I certainly wasn't here for that first half of the monastery, but for the second half. And as far as I can tell, that hasn't changed. And that's really what's most important of all. The heart of the monastery, the heart of the practice, the heart of the teachings, the point of all this is always the same. It's always suffering and the end of suffering. It's all just a vehicle for that purpose. All these buildings, all these people, these robes, these haircuts, it's all for the same purpose, the same end, which is peace, which is what all of us have always wanted, what we've always been looking for, even before we got here and found this. We all have that same yearning, that same longing to be happy, to feel safe, to be satisfied, content, to stop searching, to find that which we're seeking, that which we've always been looking for. And one of the great ironies of it all is that it's right here. And it's what we truly are. And it's always been here. It's always going to be here. We just can't see it exactly. It's obscured. We believe things that aren't true about who we are and what we are and one another. And so in order to get back to this thing, this peace, the home, our true home, it requires all of this. It requires these monasteries. I mean, ideally, of course, it doesn't, you know, you just have the teachings and you can realize it, but really you know, as monks, we have 227 precepts that we follow. It takes that many precepts in order to sort of keep the container together. It takes these robes, it takes these ordinations, whether it's the five precepts or the 227 precepts, that container is what is required to keep it together in order to do the work, to practice, to contemplate, and ultimately to realize for ourselves our true nature. And of course, it isn't like we just have to hold out until the end. You know, there is peace along the way. Obviously, for most of us, there's some sort of opening in the beginning, the very beginning. And then we spend years trying to get back to that. But as we practice, as we learn how to hold these things skillfully, we get glimpses, we get a taste, we get hopefully increased peace, increased well-being, as we become more skilled and adept at cultivating metta, cultivating patience, equanimity, gratitude, all these barmi, all these skillful qualities, become more adept at knowing the breath, not too tight, not too loose, mindfulness of the body, looking into, seeing into anicca, instability, insecurity, change, dukkha, suffering, pain, discontent, anatta, not self, not me, not mine, just nature, just elements. And what these monasteries do and what this place does is it supports us, it holds us while we practice, while we struggle, while we succeed and fail. And I'm sure for all of us, perhaps I'm just speaking for myself, but pretty sure I'm not, it does take a lot of failure. It's a lab. It's a laboratory within which we throw stuff at the wall and find what sticks, see what works, what practices, what teachings, what ways of looking at things lead each of us to a place of well-being, to a place of peace. Because that's really, in the end, what it's all about. Does it work? And some things are going to work for some people and some things aren't going to work for other people, and that's fine. There's many teachings, there's many practices. But the monastery supports us, the monastery holds us, and the monastery frees us from other concerns and other worries and other responsibilities and allows us to dedicate ourselves to this practice. Whether we come as a guest, we stay as a permanent resident, or we end up ordaining as a monastic. And obviously we're allowed to do this, we're given this opportunity because of the lay community. We wouldn't have any of this if it wasn't for the lay community. It's, you know, my very life is sustained by the gifts of others. The electricity, the food, the clothes. And at this point, for any of us who've been here longer than 7 years, these very bodies essentially have been given to us by the lay community. I hope that doesn't sound too esoteric. Meaning that, like, the body sort of is essentially like a new body every 7 years. I hope I'm not saying something that's completely incorrect scientifically. But this is my understanding. It's like, it's a great privilege. It's a great opportunity. And it's just a constant offering for a constant reflection on gratitude. For myself, the lay community here at Abhayagiri, currently the lay community out at Temple, and in previous monasteries I stayed at. And I would think about, you know, you're really not asked to give reflections until you're 10 vasa, which is for the best. And, you know, because the first few years, you're just kind of like, you know, let me get up there, show these people how to do this. And then at a certain point, you become humbled. And then when you start doing it, it's just the whole can of worms and all sorts of stuff to practice with. But it's essentially this first 12 years, you know, you're here as a guest and then you're an Anagarika for a year, you're a novice for a year. And it's the way I started to see it after a while was it's sort of like you're in school, you know, ideally to get a doctorate, because that's a large chunk of time where that first 12 years, all you really have to do most of the time is just sit there and be quiet and not have too weird of an expression on your face. And if you can do that, you could, you know, they'll let you stick around. And it's 12 years just to sort of soak in the practice and the Dhamma, to hear Dhamma talks again and again. Ajahn's here visiting the Ajahn's that we listen to on our MP3 players, reading Dhamma, practicing Dhamma. And it's ultimately just such an amazing gift to have, just be a monk, just be nobody, going nowhere, don't have to be anyone, you know, clean the bathroom, clean the toilet, sort of Thai forest tradition hallmark, sweep, and realizing hopefully more and more that that's where the real peace lies, the real joy lies, in being no one, going nowhere, nothing special. And there's so many wonderful teachers in our tradition, and they have different angles, different, each one has a different feel to them, I've found. And some are going to be more helpful for some people, and some are going to be more helpful for other people. And it's all about just finding what's helpful for you, what works for you, what for you leads to peace, leads to well-being. Is it cultivating metta? Is it resting in awareness? Is it the asupa practice, the contemplation of the unbeautiful? And then trusting in that. Once you do find a few things that work for you, trusting in those things, those methods, those practices. In the Buddha's admonition to be a light unto ourselves, there's a great degree of self-reliance, self-trust that's sort of unavoidable in this practice. And we do have one another. And that sangha, that community is integral, there's no way around it. It's crucial. We have teachers, we have one another. And yet at the end of the day, we have to go back to our huts by ourselves, or after the meal, as it were. And we have to have faith in our own investigation, in our own results, in our own observation of those results and what works. We have to have faith in our own ability to even practice in the first place. So there's this balance between taking refuge in the monastery and in the teacher and in the community, and taking refuge in oneself. You know, Ajahn Amaro described Ajahn Chah's teaching as having two things that he spoke about more than any other, and those are patient endurance and an emphasis on personal experience. And I think that emphasis on personal experience holds throughout the Thai forest tradition. There certainly are teachings, and there are teachings that we hear repeatedly again and again. And yet, which of those teachings works for us? That's for us to find out and to see for ourselves and to experiment with and ultimately realize. And there's no way around learning to trust oneself. And obviously learning to trust the teachings and the practices and these methods. And one thing that I found to be a great solace, a great comfort again and again to contemplate and to remember, is those that have gone before me, which is really why I ended up ordaining in the first place. You know, when I was a kid, I never wanted to be a monk. It wasn't on my radar. And I did start meditating at some point in college, but even still, it was never like, yeah, then I'm going to go be a monk. But traveling in Thailand and meeting different teachers and getting a hit of like, oh, wow, I didn't realize this was possible. And these people that I met, teachers that I met, it was through being Buddhist monks that they came to this peace, this wisdom. And I hope and I assume it's true for most of us here. We've had the opportunity to come across teachers, whether here or at other monasteries, Lumpur Liam, Lumpur Samedo, Ajahn Jundi, Champasano, Ajahn Sujito, you know, there's a whole long list of heavy hitters. And in my experience, and I assume with yours, when we meet them, we get a taste of or a hit of what's possible with this practice. We see a little, hopefully, of what we're seeking, what we want. And there's no great secret. It's through these monasteries and it's through these teachers and teachings and practices. That's how they got that. And in my experience, the encouragement from all of them is always, and so can you, and so should you, you know, if you like. Ajahn Mahabua would say, one's attitude toward the practice should be, if he can do it, I can do it. And that's for everyone here without exception. I think a lot of us have this view of like, well, you know, they can do it. And it's true that they are ultimately that. You know, like Lompoar Smeda says over and over again, you know, you are the awareness. All of us are the awareness. And I think for a lot of us, it can be like, yeah, you're the awareness, but I'm not sure if I'm the awareness. Or you can realize this, but for myself, I am somehow especially, whatever you want to call it, faulted, inept, bad. But that's all just rubbish. That's all just a story. And really, if we're going to trust anybody about who and what we truly are, I personally have my faith in these teachers. And it's also there, if you like, in the present to look and to be observed and experienced for oneself. But none of these teachings and none of these practices are rocket science or unattainable or unrealizable or unpracticable. They're all very doable. The breath is right there. The awareness is right there. They're always right there. The body's right there. One can pick up these teachings, pick up these practices, and put them to work. That's what they're for. They're there for the taking. And these fruits of peace and well-being and ease are available. And it's what we all want. It's what we're all seeking, all longing for. And what the Buddha has laid out for us is a very clear path on how to get there, which is essentially how to get back there, back to ourselves, back to where we already are. And it's through sila and these precepts. It's through the cultivation of skillful qualities, skillful mental states, loving kindness, forgiveness, compassion, patience, faith. It's through simply knowing the breath, staying with the breath, staying with the body, through resting in awareness, trusting in awareness, coming back again and again to the present moment. So many of these practices are about the same stuff, the same things, again and again. Just building up strength, skill in these practices, and sticking with it. You know, adhidhana parami, determination, resolution. And Kanti, patience, because it does take time. I think that's the thing. It is there for the taking. It's there for anyone interested. But in my experience, it does take time. And I think, you know, Ajahn Sujito, when he was last at Temple Monastery, when we paid respects and asked forgiveness, said, okay, give it 40 years. I think that sounds about right. I hope that would be outstanding. But it's a nice way to frame it. It's not okay. It'll take forever. It's never going to happen. It's going to take a long time, but it's doable. You know, it's like if we were going to all set out together to walk from here to New York City, it would take a long time. I don't know exactly how long it would take, but, and if some of us have this notion of, okay, we're going to walk from here to New York City and it'll take about 10 minutes or 2 days. One, it's not true. It's unrealistic and it would be really miserable, you know? Our expectations would not be in accordance with reality. But if we had this expectation, okay, this is going to take us months, or in this case, with the practice, years, then we can settle in. Just get comfortable with being uncomfortable and just be patient with the process, because the process itself is nature, is organic. And there's only so much we can do. It isn't to say that there's nothing we can do when we just sit back and let it happen. But it's also not true to say, you know, you can expedite the process and make it happen super fast. It's going to take how long it takes. But there's a middle way between those. And it's going to take how long it takes, but we just keep putting money in the bank, as it were, day after day, making deposits, practicing, sitting, walking, cultivating these skillful mental states, investigating, coming back again and again to the present, to the awareness, to the body, to the breath. And it adds up. It's cumulative. And maybe at some point we see, okay, yeah, I feel a little better. I'm a little bit better at this. I may not completely have the hang of it, but I'm figuring some stuff out. And ultimately, we have to let go of the results. And it takes how long it takes. We surrender to the process, surrender to the practice, and keep cultivating faith, whatever it is that gives rise to faith for oneself, whether it's contemplating our teachers and their practice and the fruits of their practice. Or, you know, I always found inspiration from seeing the progress in my fellow monastics. Sometimes it's easier to see progress in others than it is to see progress in oneself. And yeah, and some of the people sitting here today, I would notice along the way, be like, oh, wow, that's different than how it was a few years ago. And it's incredibly moving and incredibly inspiring. And it gives, in Thai, I would say gum lung jai, gives encouragement. And it's important also to reflect, if one can, on one's own progress. These small victories, you know. Hey, I didn't snap at that person just now. I might have said something a few years ago, but I didn't say anything. Or just a bit more skill in developing kindness and love within oneself. And that's to be made much of, to be focused on. Because all this stuff, all these statues and all of us and these buildings, the point of all of this is peace. The realization of Nibbana, the cessation of suffering, it's all for the practice. The entirety of the Buddha's teachings is that's it. That's what it's all about. And if you're interested in practicing, if you're interested in sitting meditation and contemplating these teachings, this is a wonderful place to do so. I'm exceedingly grateful that I had the good fortune to ordain here and practice here with Lompur and Ajahn Yanako and all the monks that are here today. I've met a bunch of monks in my time, and not all monks are fortunate enough to come from a place like this. In my mind, I began to compare it to somebody from a good family, a strong family. You know, you eat dinner every evening together, and parents raise you well and teach you well and look after you, or someone from perhaps a broken home. But all of us really had that here and had the good fortune to be able to lay such a good foundation in the practice. And it's irreplaceable. You know, it's a gift of immeasurable value because it's a gift that leads to peace. And the thing that's so outstanding and such a great blessing about these practices and these teachings is that they actually have results. They actually lead to that which we all seek, whereas so many things in the world, and certainly everything I did previously, you can become so skilled at something, whether you're an Olympic runner, architect, musician, and you can achieve all these great accolades in the world. And yet, one hears stories of people realizing these things and then kind of disappointed at the end. But not with this. Not for any monk or nun or layperson who practices, there will not be disappointment at the end of it. Because what it leads to is what we all want in our heart of hearts. True satisfaction, true well-being, true refuge. And along the way to finding that true home and these monasteries, even though they're not the ultimate refuge, they are the refuge that leads to that ultimate refuge. We can take refuge in communities such as this and teachers such as these. And it will allow us and afford us the opportunity and the chance and the space to realize that true refuge beyond all other refuges within ourselves. I feel incredibly blessed to have lived here. I feel incredibly blessed to be here today. And I feel that we're all incredibly blessed for this opportunity. I wish you nothing but the best in your practice.